It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station, broadcasting from frozen, rainy Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 35 degrees on the tiny back porch behind the station. They're registering 37 degrees at the airport, and they're still calling for a high of 46 today. I don't know if we're going to make it. This weather is going to continue. Rain, heavy at times, east wind 35 today. For tonight, more heavy rain, a low of 45 tonight, southeast wind to 40 tonight. And for Saturday, more rain, high near 49 on Saturday, southeast wind 35 gusting to 45. So rainy and windy for the next couple of days. Coming up on the Midday Report, Dylan Simard with a story about how the Coast Guard has been striving to keep Emergency Channel 16 up on VHF. An update on the COVID trends in the state of Alaska. And Wrangell has joined other southeast communities for stronger protections from mines in Canada that straddle transboundary watersheds. Those stories and more after this.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The FDA is officially clearing kid-sized doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds. The doses are lower than what teens and adults get. Data show the shots are nearly 91% effective at preventing symptomatic infection. On the eve of the G20 summit in Rome, President Biden's conceding he did not handle things as well as he could have with the U.S.'s oldest ally. France has said it was blindsided when the U.S. announced plans to enter into a security pact that cost France a major defense contract with Australia. Today, Biden sought to make amends.
What happened was, to use an English phrase, what we did was clumsy. It was not done with a lot of grace. I was under the impression certain things had happened that hadn't happened.
France says it lost a major submarine deal with Australia after Canberra was promised classified data from the U.S. and the U.K. to develop nuclear-powered submarines. President Biden and his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron spoke today about new ways to work together in the Indo-Pacific, where China's territorial aggression are of increasing concern to Washington. For the first time, a detainee at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has testified publicly about CIA interrogation practices. NPR's Quill Lawrence reports on tactics that have been widely acknowledged as torture.
The Associated Press reports that Majid Khan, a Pakistani citizen and former resident of Baltimore, told a jury at his sentencing hearing that he was stripped naked, suspended from a beam, doused repeatedly with ice water to keep him awake, sexually assaulted, and waterboarded during the years he was held at secret CIA sites. Khan was moved to Guantanamo in 2006. He pleaded guilty in 2012 to murder and terrorism charges related to being an Al-Qaeda courier involved in planning several attacks in the U.S. that were never carried out. The enhanced interrogation tactics approved by the George W. Bush administration have been labeled torture by human rights organizations and acknowledged as such by U.S. officials. Quill Lawrence, NPR News.
Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger says he will not run for re-election. Here's NPR's Barbara Sprott.
The six-term congressman is a vocal critic of former President Donald Trump. He's one of 10 House Republicans who voted to impeach the former president in January, and the second of that group to announce they will not seek re-election. In doing so, Kinzinger lamented the lack of civility in politics and politicians' use of fear as a political strategy.
We've allowed leaders to reach power selling the false premise that strength comes from degrading others and dehumanizing those that look, act, or think differently than we do.
Kinzinger represents a Chicago area district that is expected to be redrawn by Democrats in the Illinois legislature. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow closes the day up 89 points. This is NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For mariners in trouble in Alaska, VHF Emergency Channel 16 is a vital lifeline, but the system has suffered some significant outages in recent years. KMXT's Dylan Simard has a story about how the Coast Guard has been striving to keep those communications up and running.
The U.S. Coast Guard reports intermittent VHF outages on the emergency Channel 16, but says the situation has improved in the past 2 years. That's according to Commander Lyle Kessler, a Coast Guard spokesman.
In 2019, in January, was our worst that we'd had. I believe it was 19 sites that we had down at one time. Right now, there's only 3 sites down. It's been getting better and better. We switched contractors a couple of years ago, and we also made some improvements to the contract that allowed the contractors to do maintenance while they were doing repairs at the same time. So enable them to do more work, essentially, than what the old contract had.
Relay towers near Mount MacArthur, Cape Fanshawe, and Beatty Island are at the best semi-functional and at the worst completely inoperable. The affected areas include the inland waters north of Afognak Island, the coast near Mount MacArthur west of Wrangell, and the area of Stevens Passage and Frederick Sound east of Cake. The Coast Guard says that these outages are expected to continue for the time being. Kessler says the remoteness of the locations and extreme weather of late have made repairs difficult.
The Coast Guard over the past couple of years has been going through a process of upgrading all of the power generation and microwave links up to more current technology. The microwaves are, I think, like 1960s, 1970s technology or something, but upgrading them to newer equipment or newer parts on those equipment at all the sites across Alaska. And that work is scheduled to be done next summer. So next summer, all the sites should have new power generation capabilities and new microwave links. And that's been the majority of the reason that the sites have been down.
Kessler advises mariners to keep a secondary means of communications on board their vessels, such as a cell phone or satellite phone, and to file a float plan and carry emergency equipment on board.
Average daily COVID-19 cases are down about 15% over the last week in Alaska, but state health officials say it doesn't mean that the surge is over.
Cases really haven't been decreasing. Basically, we've been at a level off period for the last 6 weeks at least, probably closer to 2 months.
That's epidemiologist Joe McLaughlin on a call with reporters on Thursday. While case counts have seesawed, hospitalizations reached record levels over the past week. About 230 Alaskans are currently in the hospital with COVID-19, representing 1 in 5 patients hospitalized in the state. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ann Zink says, despite an influx of hundreds of out-of-state health workers last month, hospital resources are still stretched.
We continue to do everything we can to not get to the point that we're making a decision between who gets which specific resource, but that work has actually increased over the last week from what we've seen before.
Alaska continues to lead the country in its average daily case rate, according to the New York Times. A Dillingham Census area man in his 50s recently died of COVID-19, the state health department announced on Thursday. The state also reported the deaths of a Kenai man in his 80s, a Soldotna man in his 40s, a Haines man in his 70s, and a Juneau woman in her 40s. A total of 695 Alaskans have died from COVID-19 so far during the pandemic. Wrangell has joined with a dozen other southeast municipal and tribal governments in calling for stronger protections from mines in Canada that straddle transboundary watersheds. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, Wrangell's assembly and residents say the issue is especially pressing to the community, which sits in the mouth of the British Columbia-originated Stikine River.
Wrangell's assembly has unanimously called on Canadian regulators to immediately pause permitting, development, and expansion of mines upstream from southeast Alaska's waterways. It's also asking the provincial government of British Columbia to permanently ban the practice of storing liquid mine waste behind earthen dams. That's because there aren't financial or legal protections in place for southeast Alaska tribes and communities that depend on transboundary salmon watersheds. If a mine dam failed in Canada, they argue, the downstream waste could devastate the environment and economy of communities like Wrangell. Wrangell Mayor Steve Prasunka said he's seen firsthand how mines have been abandoned in Canada. In a previous job, he ran canoe trips on the Iskut River near the old Johnny Mountain mine site.
And I'm here to tell you, it was insane. This was shortly after the shutdown, and they literally walked away. We would go into a building, and there would still be the beakers inside the lab with Bunsen burners and rain gear still suspended. It was like they just disappeared. And over the course of 3 years or 4 years, I watched that tailings pond drain down the side of the mountain.
Mining industry publications report that the former Johnny Mountain mine was further cleaned in 2017. But Prasanka's larger point was that it's important to protect Wrangell from legacy pollution. The Stikeen River is integral to Wrangell's fishing economy, the work of the community's marine service center, and the traditional lifestyle of the indigenous population. Wrangell resident and artist Brenda Schwartz-Jaeger spoke in favor of the action at the Assembly's Tuesday meeting.
I don't think this community would exist at all if it wasn't for the remarkable richness and bounty of the Stikeen. It's a fragile ecosystem.
Schwartz-Jaeger told the Assembly she finds it incredible and scary, the size of the tailings upriver from Wrangell. The largest mine operating on the Stikeen River watershed is the Red Chris Mine, operated by Imperial Metals since 2015. That's the same company that operated the Mount Polly Mine that had a tailings dam failure in 2014. The tailings dam, which holds mine waste from the Red Chris Mine, is more than twice as tall.
We have a lot to lose, and they kind of have a lot to gain and really not a lot to lose. And I feel like we need a place at the table, and I feel like this resolution will help bring us closer to using the treaty to put some teeth in the agreements.
The Petersburg Assembly recently passed a similar resolution calling on its Canadian neighbors to tighten restrictions on mines along transboundary Alaska watersheds, including the Stikeen, Taku, and Yunik rivers. The Mining Association of British Columbia responded with a letter defending its safety record. Reached for comment, the industry group pointed to the October letter that says BC's mine sector has made improvements to tailings dam oversight and safety in the years since the Mount Polly disaster. The Southeast Alaska Indigenous Transboundary Commission is a coalition of 15 tribes that banded together in the wake of the 2014 dam failure. Wrangell tribal citizen Tis Peterman is a former executive director of the commission and said in an interview that they're still working to gain representation as stakeholders in transboundary watersheds.
We feel as tribal members in Southeast Alaska that we should have a voice, because anything that's being done on the BC side on transboundary mining is going to affect downstream communities.
Wrangell's local tribe, the Wrangell Cooperative Association, is a member of SEITC and has already passed a resolution asking for more engagement and protections from the effects of transboundary mines, Peterman said.
It's literally in our back door, out the back door. Look across the back channel. There's Canada.
The years following the Mount Polly mine disaster renewed calls for transboundary mining permit requests to be considered under what's called the International Joint Commission. The IJC was formed under the Boundary Waters Treaty of 1909 and is meant to resolve water disputes between the U.S. and Canada. But Alaska critics say that call for IJC oversight of transboundary mines hasn't borne fruit.
Until we have binding protections in place, we are just sitting ducks below what everybody calls these ticking time bombs.
That's Jill Weitz, the Juneau-based campaign director for Salmon Beyond Borders, one of the organizations that requested a resolution on transboundary mining protections from Wrangell's government.
We're not under the illusion that mining is going to stop or that any of us are going to stop mining in British Columbia. We need some of these resources towards the energy transition that is underway in face of a changing climate. But mining can be done better. It has to be done better.
Earlier this year, the government of BC did invite the tribal consortium SEITC to meet about transboundary mining and other tribal environmental concerns. It was the first such meeting for Southeast tribes. That's in addition to discussions underway with the Tahltan central government on Canada's side of the border about mining safety and Indigenous input in the permitting process. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
A key player in Anchorage Mayor Dave Bronson's response to homelessness has resigned. John Morris, an anesthesiologist who served as the city's homeless coordinator since July, confirmed Monday in a text message that he was resigning. He declined any further comment. The news surfaced at a Thursday morning assembly work session about moving the city's largest homeless shelter out of the Sullivan Arena. The news seemed to take administration officials by surprise, including Chief of Staff Sammy Graham and Health Director Joe Gerace. It also left assembly members surprised as they questioned the administration about recent reports of violence and disorganization at the Sullivan. A private company, 99 Plus One, took over operations of the Sullivan last month. Assembly members also questioned where Morris's departure left its efforts to move out of the Sullivan, which has served as the city's emergency shelter since the pandemic began. Morris was part of a six-member group of administration representatives and assembly members working on a plan to move approximately 400 people out of the Sullivan. Another member, senior advisor Craig Campbell, resigned last week. Several other members of Bronson's administration who are involved with homelessness have also left recently. Bob Dole was integral in setting up the Sullivan Arena shelter last March. He announced he will resign in November. Sean Hayes, the mass care lead who oversaw operations at the Sullivan Arena and other non-congregate shelters, was fired last week. Hayes says she is considering options related to her dismissal. She previously told Alaska Public Media that she had not been told of any performance issues before she was fired. Democrats in Congress continue to debate what should be in President Biden's social infrastructure bill, but a version that emerged yesterday includes a paragraph that would close the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling and cancel existing leases. The paragraph would repeal the Anwer section of the 2017 budget bill. That section, authored by Senator Lisa Murkowski, requires two oil lease sales in the Arctic Refuge by the end of 2024. The repeal paragraph is in a 1,700-page bill debated yesterday in the House Rules Committee. The bill is likely to change and could be replaced entirely. If the House passes it, the bill would go to the Senate, where all Democrats would have to approve it. The drilling repeal might not go over too well with Senator Joe Manchin. The West Virginia Democrat has previously voted in favor of opening the Arctic Refuge to drilling. In January, the Trump administration held the first lease sale in the refuge. Seven of the nine tracts went to the state-owned Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority. If the repeal goes through, the leases would be canceled immediately with payments returned to the ADEA and the two companies that won leases. The Bureau of Land Management is considering lands along the Richardson Highway in the Thompson Pass area for a potential exchange with an Alaska Native corporation. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the BLM is laying administrative groundwork for the potential exchange, which has drawn public concern about environmental and outdoor recreation impacts in the Alpine region north of Valdez.
The Bureau of Land Management conducted an environmental analysis of the potential transfer of up to 1,200 acres in the Thompson Pass area to Chugach Alaska Corporation in exchange for remote corporation acreage in the Wrangell Mountains to the east.
Just studying the potential impacts if a land exchange were to occur.
BLM Alaska spokesperson Melinda Bolton says the agency issued the environmental assessment and a proposed amendment to the East Alaska Resource Management Plan to allow for the land exchange.
And we now have a signed finding of no significant impact or FONSI.
A provision in the 2019 Dingle Conservation Management and Recreation Act requires the BLM to analyze lands to potentially trade with Chugach Alaska for corporation acreage bound by Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council habitat protections. Chugach did not provide someone to speak on the issue, but a statement released earlier by Corporation Board Chair Sherry Beretta and posted in the Copper River Record says Chugach wants the Thompson Pass lands to gain access to adjacent acreage where it has subsurface rights, adding there's no current development plan. The BLM's Bolton says there are no mining claims in the area.
The mineral value in the area is low, according to a current USGS U.S. Geological Survey assessments. The terrain is challenging, weather would be challenging, and there's currently no infrastructure in the area to support that kind of development.
Bolton also minimizes potential effects on outdoor recreation, explaining that the targeted acreage only represents about 10% of BLM area lands currently used for recreation.
So anybody wanting to recreate in the area would still have access to over 10,000 acres of BLM and state-managed lands.
The area of Thompson Pass targeted for exchange is popular with skiers, snowboarders, and snow machiners. And Bolton says the agency has heard concerns about losing access.
An important point that a lot of people brought up during our comments, our public comment meetings on it.
Prime public recreation land being transferred to a private corporation who is currently exploring metal mining in five areas of the Chugach region, is certainly of concern.
Thompson Pass area resident and advocate Lisa Wax is among those who submitted comments opposed to transfer of Pass area lands to Chugach, Alaska.
142 very diverse folks, from hunters to defenders of wildlife, motorheads, self-propelled enthusiasts, even a retired Alaskan Republican senator, all wrote comments saying, not this land.
Wax says existing state and federal Thompson Pass management plans prioritize recreation.
And even specify that the recreation value is higher than the potential mineral value.
Wax notes that the Dingell Act requires the BLM to study all lands in the region for potential future exchanges.
I think it's essential for the public to understand that there are 240,000 acres of public Chugach area land that are at risk for being transferred to the Chugach Alaska Corporation for development.
Wax says she is protesting the proposed management plan amendment, Thompson Pass environmental assessment, and finding of no significant impact. Filing a protest is an option for those involved in the Thompson Pass land exchange analysis or who would be directly affected by its approval. The BLM's Bolton notes that any actual land exchange would require another review process. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
This is Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. It's Halloween, and these scary sea stories will haunt you for life. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
Sunday night is Halloween. Kodiak fishermen shared some of their real-life scary stories with Fish Radio.
We were hauling gear at about 2 or 3 in the morning, and we wanted to let the gear soak. While I was napping, I had a dream, and in that dream, I was in a bar, and I encountered a woman who was attractive, and she turned into a sea hag, and I ended up with my foot on her face, and I was pulling her by both ears, and they were stretching in my hands all the way up past my head, and she was, cackling at me, and a very short time later, I sunk my boat in the same place. So that's my sea hag story.
We were offloaded. We ran back out late at night. We were hauling gear. Next thing I looked up, and a pot broke over the starboard side, and I see either run for cover or grab onto the pot. And I did the old death grip on the pot there, and the wave broke over, hit my shoulder, and I just held on for dear life. Looked around, there was my friends. They were like a bowling pin on the deck. I told my skipper, that's enough. Time to head in.
And I wake up with his nose about 3 inches from mine, yelling at the top of his lungs that, we're sinking! We're sinking! And I looked out the window, and everything was great. Then I realized the guy was asleep. He did it to me 3 times. That was scary.
I flipped my skiff over on Alatak Beach, landed right on top of me. I was trapped underneath it for like a minute. Wasn't easy. I just managed, there was a little angle from bow to stern, so I managed to slip through there because the boat was kind of bouncing around the surface.
I had a line set around my neck one time as we were throwing the gear overboard. Yeah, that was kind of scary.
Other Kodiak fishermen shared what scares them.
People dying, yeah, that's probably it. Prices, but they're getting better.
Getting impaled by multiple halibut hooks and dragged under the sea and dying.
In my mind, the scariest thing about fishing is not being able to swim.
Don't crash.
Death to farm fish.
Not making any money.
Wishing everyone a safe and happy Halloween. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Just because we're staying at a safe distance doesn't mean we have to miss out on Halloween. On October 29th, go downtown from 3:30 to 5 for outdoor trick-or-treating at participating local businesses. After you load up on candy, drive by KMXT's Pumpkin Parade to ogle town carving talent. And cap off your night from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. by stopping at the Kodiak Public Library for a Kodiak Spooky Story Stroll in the Dark. For more information, go to kmxt.org and check out the community calendar or Facebook page.
J.
Chimay, the Shunek tribe is hosting a virtual Alutiiq Nation Festival Friday, November 19th and Saturday, November 20th. Learn to say Chimay, craft with Alutiiq artists, and connect with community. There will be a variety of language and art classes to sign up for, including embroidery, beading, carving, skin sewing, salve making, and more. Registration is now open at shunek.org or find the forum on the Shunek Facebook page. Class sizes are limited and registration is first come, first serve. Registration closes October 31st and preference will be given to members of the Alutiiq Sukhbiak Nation. This message is brought to you by the Shunek Tribe of Kodiak and the Administration of Native Americans. Kuyana.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Welcome to your Island Messenger for Friday. It is the 29th day of October, the year 2021. We'll look for this wet, windy weather to continue for the next couple of days. These west winds, which are already blowing up near 35, or these easterly winds are expected to turn to the southeast and blow to 40, 45 for the next 2 days. That's going to bring us some heavy rain and lots of it, although it's kind of snowy rainy right now. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up here on the east side at 2:56 p.m. That will be a 4.6-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 8:50 this evening of 6.7 feet. Over on the west side, you have a low tide coming up at 4:04 p.m. That will be a 6.8-foot tide in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 9:26 p.m. of 10.2 feet. Mariners, this weather is going to affect you too. Gale warnings through Saturday for both sides of the island. From Marmot Island to Sitkanak, southeast 35 right now, will increase to 45 this afternoon. Seas building to 16 feet today and 25 feet tonight. For tomorrow on our east side, southeast 45 and seas to 29 feet. Over in the Shelikof, gale warning today and Saturday, east winds to 30 will increase to 45 knots this afternoon, seas to 12 feet. For tomorrow, east 35, seas to 9 feet. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session Tuesday, November 2nd. The meeting will begin at 6:30 p.m. Elected officials may be participating via audio-video conferencing. Public members are encouraged to tune into KMXT on 100.1 FM. And you can find the packet and a link to the web streaming at the City of Kodiak website. The council is also having a special council meeting on Thursday. That meeting will also begin at 6:30 p.m. Elected officials may be participating via audio-video conferencing. The public portion of the meeting will be web-streamed, and the web-streaming link and meeting packets are available at the City of Kodiak website. If you need more information, call the clerk at 486-8636. The City of Kodiak and Kodiak Island Borough Cooperative Relations Committee will hold a meeting on Wednesday, November 3rd at 4 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. This meeting is open to the public. For agendas and meeting packets, go to the City of Kodiak website or call the clerk at 486-8636.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.
KMXT is supported in part by Orion's Mountain Sports, featuring equipment, clothing, and footwear for your outdoor lifestyle. Orion's Mountain Sports, located at 1247 Mill Bay Road. Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to the October 29th edition of Island Byways. I'm Pam Foreman. Halloween weekend has finally arrived, and as usual, our weather is going to be challenging. My first Halloween in Alaska, just shy of 40 years ago, was in the interior of the state, and it was well below zero when the kids went out to trick-or-treat.
There, costumes were covered by parkas or were made large enough to accommodate lots of layers under the costume. Here, we mainly need to make sure no costume parts will blow off in the wind and that rain gear can somehow be incorporated. To start off your weekend of fun, there's downtown trick-or-treating from 3:30 to 5 p.m. on Friday. You can start at the Chamber of Commerce in the Ferry Terminal building. You'll get a sticker, instructions, and info on the hidden golden pumpkins along the trail. You can download a map at kodiakchamber.org. Then pile in the car and warm up a while you drive through KMXT's Pumpkin Parade. The route is from the high school parking lot, then along Egan Way past KMXT and the library. The Pumpkin Parade goes from 5 to 7 p.m. Once you finish there, stop in at the library for a spooky story stroll. Read a story by flashlight and get your photo taken with the Scarecrow. That runs from 4:30 to 6:30 Friday night. The Spooky Story Stroll will be happening through November 2nd. If you have a carved pumpkin you'd like to show off in the Pumpkin Parade, just drop it off at KMXT between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. on Friday, October 29th. You can pick it up after the parade. And for the older members of the family, Night of the Living Dead is presented at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium this weekend by the High School Drama Club, the Shakespeares. Tickets are available at the door. And that's it for Island Byways this week. Have fun and stay safe out there. Thanks for listening.